Yeah, I'm very pleased that I was admitted to this workshop and also that you give me the opportunity to present me some ideas on flow equations of Hamiltonians. Now, this is a method we have developed in recent years. I think I first have to explain this method, and I will do this in the first part of the talk. Then one application which I think is rather easy to follow the result is interesting, is the elimination of the electron-phonon interaction. But then, of course, I will also tell you about the application to the two-dimensional Hubbard model. Now, concerning the basic idea, well, the primary idea, so to say, is very simple. It's the idea to transform a Hamiltonian continuously. And this means then as a function of some parameter, which I call the flow parameter, in such a way that the off-diagonal matrix elements decrease. And of course, the idea is that finally one has a diagonal Hamiltonian or block diagonal Hamiltonian, or well, actually in the Hubbard model, again, we will do a little bit in a different way. Now, it has turned out that basically at the same time, also Ken Wilson and Glashek thought about such a procedure for renormalization of ultraviolet divergences. And well, they have called this similarity renormalization. Now before I explain this method, I would like shortly to tell you a few things, which a few models which have been approached with this concept. Well, in the first paper, I considered an n-orbital model in the limit n going to infinity. This was insofar of interest, as with this method, normally one creates more and more complicated interactions. This means out of two particle interactions, one obtains three particle, four particle interactions, and so on. But in this limit, it turns out that the equations are closed, and therefore one could treat them well, basically in an exact way. But then there were also applications to the Luttinger model. By the way, this was also considered in one dimension, and elimination of electron-phonon interaction, Anderson impurity model, spin-boson model, some light cone physics, the Hubbard model in the strong coupling regime, Lipkin model, well, it's only to Kondo model, spin piles transition, dimerized spin chains, spin quatromeres, Sine-Gordon model. Now I will talk about finally the Hubbard model, Dirac particle in external potential, contact potential in two dimensions. And recently, it seems that Stephen White has independently also developed this method or a very similar method, and he applies it to problems in quantum chemistry. Now, after this kind of, well, let me say semi-commercial, I bring now a real commercial. Well, there will be a workshop on functional renormalization in interacting quantum many-body problems in Dresden in March next year at the Max Planck Institute for the Physics of Complex Systems. And well, if you are interested, you may apply by November 15th. Well, I post this also. It's beside my office door here, and then you can also see this internet address. Yeah, but now let me really come to the basic idea. As I told you before, the idea is to perform a continuous unitary transformation. U of L is now this uni transformation S function of some flow parameter L. If we differentiate this equation, then it can be written that this derivative of the Hamiltonian is the commutator of the generator of this transformation with the Hamiltonian itself. And eta, of course, in order that this is a unitary transformation, has to be anti-Hermitian. That's somehow the basic equation, but now, of course, it's a question how to choose this generator, since we would like that the off-diagonal matrix elements decrease. Now, this is an, so to say, very simple example, which gives one some idea how to choose eta. Now, this, well, it's just a 2x2 matrix, and this is now our eta. It has to be anti-Hermitian, therefore, if this is some general complex number, then we have to have here minus its complex conjugate. In principle, we could also have some imaginary numbers here, but they would only rotate the states, and it's not really interesting. Now, it's easy to calculate the commutator, and we would like that here h decreases, and therefore we have to choose a in an appropriate way. And the way to do it is to choose a so that it's this energy difference times the off-diagonal matrix element itself. Now, in this simple case here, one can perform the integration explicitly, and I have written down what the result is. Now here from this expression, you see that normally h of L goes to zero because we have this exponential here. The only exception is the case when this quantity vanishes. Now, what does this mean? That this quantity vanishes, it means that epsilon 1 equals epsilon 2. And well, then, of course, you also see that then this is 0. And in this degenerate case, so to say, the system doesn't know in which direction to transform. I can later show you in a certain case that this need not be, in general, this need not be a real problem. But now, of course, we are not going to diagonalize 2x2 matrices with this method, but we would like to apply it to quantum systems with a large Hilbert space. And it turns out that somehow a good choice for eta is to take, this is now the generalization, where did I, yeah, this expression. This is now the generalization. I multiply the off-diagonal matrix element by the difference of the two corresponding diagonal matrix elements. Now, I've written it here again. And yeah, actually, then one can write it in such a way that eta is a commutator of the diagonal part of the Hamiltonian with the Hamiltonian itself. And then, of course, one can write down what is the change of these matrix elements. And finally, we may consider what is the sum of the absolute squares of the off-diagonal matrix elements. How do they change under this flow? Of course, since the sum over all, well, including the diagonal matrix elements, well, this is trace of h squared, is constant. We can also write it in this way. But in any case, we can define that it has this form. And from this form, you see that this can only be negative. Therefore, the sum of the squares of the off-diagonal matrix elements really decreases. The only problem one can have is what happens if epsilon k equals epsilon k primed. But one should keep in mind that also these epsilons change, and therefore it turns out that it even in this degenerate case it may work. Now here I give a very simple example. Well, suppose we have consider a one-dimensional system. We have here some, it's described by some k vector, the diagonal matrix element, the dispersion should be proportional to k. And well, if moreover, our initial off-diagonal matrix elements depend only on the difference of k minus k primed. Well, actually, if you think about it, you could think about the interaction between two particles, and then this k would be the difference between the momenta of these two particles. Well, in this special case, it turns out that epsilon k stays constant, and one can see that explicitly the off-diagonal matrix elements decay in this exponential form. And from this, you already get some impression of the meaning of L, or what happens. What happens, roughly speaking, is that if we perform these transformations and our basis states, this means the basis states of H of L, have an energy width of the order 1 over square root of L. This means this energy uncertainty of the states becomes smaller and smaller. Of course, you also see that it works best if this energy difference is large, but that's not surprising. That's the same when you perform perturbation expansion. Yeah?
The Wolf procedure seems to be very similar to the Jacobi method for diagonalizing matrices. This seems to be like a continuous version of that. Is there any closer connection? Or?
Well, I don't know whether there's a closer connection, but well, Jacobi method means that normally one picks the largest off-diagonal matrix elements and then one performs a 2x2 transformation. But you see here we do it continuously, and we do it for all off-diagonal matrix elements simultaneously, not one after the other.
Second order perturbation theory would be what? You have to take one step with the finite L.
Well, I will show an example. Yeah.
May I also ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Well, you need the fact that epsilon k minus epsilon k prime exactly this factor.
No, it's not. Somehow this was so to say, the first idea, and well, you will see that I will also use some modifications. Well, it really depends on the problem. One can also do it in a different way. But in this way, one has at least some idea roughly how it should look like, so to say. Yeah, this is a basic. Idea, and now I would like to show you how this works in the case of the elimination of the electron-phonon interaction. By the way, I think it's nearly as simple as the transformation by Fröhlich, which was probably the first one for the elimination of the electron-phonon interaction, and well, which also is normally presented in introductory theoretical solid state physics courses. But well, meanwhile, I show my students also this type of transformation. And finally, you will see what the advantage is. Yeah, now what do we consider? Well, the Hamiltonian consists in total of three contributions. Now, this is a free part, well, the frequencies for the phonons and energies for the electrons. Then we will generate an electron-electron interaction, of course. And yeah, here I have written down the electron-phonon interaction. I should say that normally this matrix element depends only on Q. The reason why I write K and Q here is that under this transformation, this means as a function of L, it will really depend on both K and Q. Now, the way what I will show you here is what happens if initially we do not have an electron-electron interaction, and then we will see how the electron-electron interaction, the effective electron-electron interaction emerges from this transformation. I will do this calculation in second order in M, well, in this electron-phonon coupling, and will turn out, and you are not surprised, that this effective electron-electron interaction is then of second order in M. And as a consequence, when I calculate eta, then I have to take the, actually here I should, before I really do it, I should say a little bit more about this. Well, before I said, well, let's consider diagonal part and the off-diagonal part. Now, the way, or how one can do it in a systematic way, is to say, I will no longer say that I really diagonalize completely. I ask less. What I ask is that those terms which change the number of phonons will be eliminated. Of course, this is this electron-phonon interaction. But basically, it means that now I do not diagonalize the Hamiltonian, but I perform a block diagonalization. Block diagonalization in the sense that in each block, I have a fixed number of phonons. Now, therefore, it means the diagonal part of the Hamiltonian is now, of course, this one and this one. And now, if I consider the commutator, of course, H equals HD plus HR, therefore I can write HR. But since I am interested only in the effective interaction in second order in M, it turns out that here it is sufficient to take only H zero, the free part, and I do not need to take V since I assume that initially there's no such interaction present. Yeah, now if to evaluate this, but that's of course very simple. If I take the commutator of this term with the electron-phonon interactions, then I get something of the same form. The only difference is that now these matrix elements are multiplied by this combination of one particle energies, and I call this alpha KQ. Now that's the first step. The next step is now to insert this eta into the flow equation. Well, this is a flow equation. I have two terms here, well, at least up to order n squared. Let me first consider the commutator of eta with h0. Now, basically, the same happens as here. Now it's multiplied by another factor of alpha, and it turns out that here one has a minus sign. I think it's basically because here h0 is on the right and here h0 to the left of the commutator. And now this means from this equation I obtain how the electron-phonon interaction changes under this transformation. It is this simple differential equation, and its solution, of course, is that the initial m has to be multiplied by this exponential. This is the first step. The second step is that I calculate the commutator of eta with hr. Well, basically, then one obtains a lot of terms, but the terms we are interested in are those which constitute the effective two-particle interaction. And, well, it's easy to calculate this commutator. One obtains this result. And this means now that the change of our matrix elements for the two-particle interaction is given by this equation. And now we know how m decays, well, just exponentially here. And therefore, it's now very easy to integrate this equation. And the final result is this one. Well, actually, there's something interesting. You see that in the denominator, we have the sum of two squares. Well, each argument is such a, well, where was it? This combination of energies here, but they appear only as a sum of squares. And if I now consider in particular the contributions which are interesting for superconductivity, of course, conventional superconductivity, then these are the terms, well, let me see, where k primed equals minus k. And for these terms, I obtain this result. Now, of course, this second order result, well, one compares it with Fröhlich, and one finds that Fröhlich, or one can write Fröhlich's result in the same way. Only difference is that Fröhlich has a minus sign there. Now, it's surely not an sign error which we made. Well, actually, we always had the sum of squares And therefore, it's not possible that finally we get a difference of squares in the denominator. What you also see, and what is nice, is that this interaction is now attractive for all momenta k and q, in contrast to Frölich's result. And normally, well, in, let's say, at a low level in solid state physics, and one argues why those terms which are attractive should be more important than the others. But I must say I never did really like these kinds of argument. Whereas here it's no longer necessary to use this argument. It's attractive everywhere.
Well, you are also to an interaction which is a retarded.
Pardon?
There is no retardation in this interaction.
That's correct. The way we perform this transformation is so that our interaction is instantaneous. Yeah. Now, well, Andreas Milke looked a little bit more into this. Well, he then also used this scheme by Wilson and Glaschek, but it turns out that one, it's not quite the same result, but it's very similar to this one. Well, one can do something similar for the Schriefer-Wolf transformation. It's the same, it's in the denominator. One has a such a plus sign. I should also mention that, let me say, conventional perturbation theory and the flow equation method yield the same result if the energies before and after the scattering process are the same. Therefore, on shell, one always obtains the same result. Now, of course, one may ask, well, how is it possible that one gets a different result? Well, I don't blame Frölich. He did quite right in his calculation. The point is, here we perform a perturbation theory not for a single state. Well, of course, for a single state, we should always get the same result. But we perform perturbation theory for whole blocks. And this means that such an elimination of the off block diagonal matrix elements is not unique. You can always have some extra unitary transformation within the block. And it's simply so that here we have used a different unitary transformation, transformation which is different from the one Frölich has used. Andreas Milke then also did some calculation.
During that, what happens for the diagonal? What are the changement on the diagonal? What kind of changement introduced in the diagonal with this transformation? For instance, there are
what do you mean by diagonal? Do you mean the one particle?
The one particle, yeah.
Okay, I will say a little bit about this. Now here in this second, well, it turns out that changes in the one particle energies also appear in second order. But somehow they, since this is here in second order, they do not feed back to this calculation. But I will say a little bit about this, yeah. Well, and he now, of course, people who do realistic calculations for superconductors don't use the Frölich result. They use Eliasberg theory or some related theories.
Eliasberg theory is the same, it's just a little bit more sophisticated numerical.
It's insofar different as there one does not work with an instantaneous interaction. It's a retarded interaction. Well, one can eliminate the phonons exactly, but then one obtains a retarded interaction. And that's basically what is done in C series. And he compared the results, well, at least insofar as he calculated TC for well, various systems, and it turns out that this interaction and what one obtains from C series differs only by a few percent. They are really very close in their result. Okay.
How is the TC determined from the Hamiltonian?
Oh, well, well, as soon as one has the effective interactions, then of course one has to solve the gap equation, or one has to see where the gap goes to zero.
Okay, so one applies mean field to the renormalized Hamiltonian.
Yes.
No, this is
not
going to be the philosophy. Uh-huh. Like, this is not like renormalization group. In renormalization group, you run the flow equations until something becomes very large, and then you interpret that as an instability. Here, you're really doing everything at the same time. You keep high energy and low energy.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
So mm-hmm. How do you extract your TC, for example, to compare with Macmillan and Dines?
Oh, well, he really used this this expression and looked at the gap equation.
So it's a Hart tree. It's a mean field treatment of this interaction, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When you look at the gap equation, taking into account also the renormalization of the one particle, because in Eliasberg theory, there's a renormalization of the one particle, there's a Z, there's a quasi-particle residue, and there's also a pairing, and the two are sort of competing.
Yeah.
So you do the same with this Hamiltonian?
Now I cannot answer precisely, but he took into account some of these things which are also done in Eliasberg's theory.
Britain, you should get some kind of correction of the Fermi velocity, I think, during this process.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the Z.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Moreover, this should be should have this renormalization occurs within energy range of phonon frequency. It's like, you know, the velocity is renormalized mm-hmm. only for small energy.
Yeah.
It's an exact procedure. It's information is contained in some other way.
The general idea is that the retarded interaction that you would obtain by performing just the Gaussian integral of the phonon is traded for an effective frequency independent interaction, right? That's what has been done here. There's no retardation anymore.
No, there's no retardation, yeah. Well, I simply use a different scheme so that I never get retardation.
In order to recover the retardation, the usual basis is, of course, there. I mean, it's a fact that it takes some time until the other electron feels the action of the first one. And here, it's sort of certainly the physics is somehow included in the scheme, but in a bit of hidden way. In order to recover the other picture, is there a way to extract the retardation if I want to return to the original basis and compute some time space for retardation?
Well, I don't know whether one should really go back in such a sense. Well, it's a different approach, and my philosophy is also, well, if one really has these eigenstates, which one obtains according to ECS, then it should also be possible to have a unitary transformation to a Hamiltonian so that it is one of the basis states. Therefore, I think retardation I think for certain arguments it is good, but nevertheless it should be possible really to transform the Hamiltonian exactly, and I don't see the necessity for retardation.
It seems to me that to answer Walter's question, what one should do is apply to the flow equation to the observables that you're interested in.
Okay, okay, that's actually one we did for the phonon operators. Now what happens is that then one has to do the same transformation on the observables, and as a result it turns out that then one gets addition, let's say, to a dagger, one obtains terms of type C dagger C. Well, actually it's, well, total momentum is conserved, but then of course we have here a sum of these terms, and then finally one can evaluate the correlation function, and then one also sees damping. Therefore, it's not that damping is lost for the original operators. Pardon?
I say
damping is not lost by this procedure. Well, in the sense that I have to transform, let's say, the phonon creation operators, and if I do this, then in addition, one obtains terms of this type. Okay, let's say if this a dagger k, then it's k plus q cq sum over q with some coefficients one has to determine. And now it's obvious that excitation energies for these somehow form a whole continuum. And that's what then yields damping.
But the frequency dependence, temperature dependence, can't be just the same from the static Hamiltonian as from the dynamic. So are differences of order electron mass over ion mass or something like that? Is it correct to that order? Something?
I think it's correct, yeah.
He was finding similar results to a few percent.
Yeah.
I wondered if there's some expansion parameter.
Well, the expansion parameter is, of course, electron phonon coupling. Well, that's considered in second order and not beyond.
Coming to this point of damping, which is quite important, because apparently you are getting an Hamiltonian which is just an order than the one, which is second order in the electron phonon coupling.
Yeah.
This Hamiltonian by itself will introduce a damping only to second order in this Hamiltonian. So from this Hamiltonian, we will get the damping to something which is fourth order in the electron form of coupling.
The point is
the fermion, it has been transformed in something which is a fermion plus fermion, a lot of bosons.
Yeah, yeah.
And this one will be the damping just using this Hamiltonian. This is the idea. The field,
yeah.
Now I think about fermions. Fermion field is not just a fermion field, but it's a combination between a fermion field, a product, some creation,
phonons. Yeah.
It will be this term that will introduce the damping to the correct order.
We didn't do the calculation for the fermions. There are terms like this,
You recover damping because the original fermion now is a fermion plus a bunch of the electron of the phonon the phonon excitation.
Okay, now let me also ask about the energies. Now it's possible to consider this rather well for the phonon frequencies. Now, here I've written down the equation one obtains for the Hohnon frequencies. And yeah, again, we have this M. But now I assume that these frequencies really depend on L. This means that then also alpha depends on L. It turns out that one can solve this self-consistently. And in such a way that omega q asymptotically has such a behavior. This means it decays rather slowly to this to its value for L equal infinity. But this has also the interesting consequence that now the phonon, the electron phonon coupling obtains such a term. This term, I would say it's particularly interesting at resonance. Of course, it can be that alpha kq at infinity vanishes, then all the whole exponential vanishes. But since there is still this power law decay, it's an algebraic k, it's very slowly, but nevertheless, one has this decay, so that even in the case of a resonance for values k and q, where one has resonance, this electron phonon coupling vanishes. Yeah. Okay. Well, actually, basically it is in, well, for the phonon frequencies, it's basically in here. Well, we could calculate this L0 of Q, and then one has to plug it in. And yeah. Well, you see, you put here L equals 0, and then one has a renormalization of these frequencies. Well, unfortunately, the situation is much more difficult for the electron energies. The reason is that, well, if I consider the equation for the phonons, then in this electron phonon coupling, only the same, the frequency with the same wave vector q appears. And therefore, despite the fact that this is a rather complicated equation, fortunately, it's only one unknown function one has to determine, whereas if one tries the same for epsilons, then they are not separate for different values of the momentum k. Yeah.
You could not have done the opposite, have eliminated the electrons and just look at the phonons and so on of the system.
Eliminate the phonons?
No, maybe you would simply say,
yeah.
What is it that made the renormalization, say, of the phonon frequencies an easy task, you said? But getting the, I understood what you said, that the band renormalization for the electrons is complicated.
Yeah, well, it's complicated. The reason is that one, for the electron energies, one has coupled equations between different momenta, and this makes it much more difficult. Well, we have tried, but I think we have not yet a really reasonable solution to this problem.
How can I calculate TC if you don't know the normalization of electron spectrum? That's what kind of question.
Oh.
It's too complicated. You cannot.
Yeah, it's strong coupling corrections. Or include strong coupling corrections.
Then what does comparison with the electric equation mean? Electric equation is this strong coupling. So when you say that you compare that with electric equations, it will be coupling or a strong coupling?
Well, it's performed for weak coupling.
So that's basically VCS equations without mass normalization, without
normalization. Well, actually, in the comparison here is also introduced, so to say, the corresponding factors for renormalization. Yeah, now I finally come to the Hubbard model. It's work together with Ina Grote, Emma Körting, Vasil Hankevich. And yeah, now again, I have to tell you a little bit about the strategy we have used. Perhaps before I should say the following. I mentioned in the beginning that I did some calculation for an electronic system, an n orbital model with n going to infinity. This was a calculation at zero temperature. And actually at this occasion, when I did this calculation, I realized that one cannot somehow simply say that the generator eta is a commutator of the Hamiltonian with the diagonal part. Apparently the reason that this does not work if one does it in such a way. Well, actually I got equations and one could, so to say, start to solve them, but then it turned out that certain couplings diverged, and of course that's not what one, what I expected. Now the reason is that if I take only the diagonal part of the Hamiltonian of the two particle interaction, then this is, for this calculation, apparently something of measure zero. It means one would take only terms like CK Dekker CK, CQ Dekker CQ, but no other terms. And apparently that's not enough. Now, what I did then was the following, that I said, well, it's not really necessary to diagonalize the Hamiltonian somehow completely. Instead, it's already useful if I block diagonalize it in the following sense. I require that the number of, that those terms are considered diagonal, which conserve the number of quasi-particles. Now, what means quasi-particles? It means electrons above the Fermi edge and holes below the Fermi edge. And actually, if one is able to eliminate those terms which violate this number, a typical example would be, suppose we appear something like the Fermi sphere, and suppose one electron hops here, and let's say the other one in this direction, then apparently here the number of quasi-particles isn't changed, but here we create a hole plus a particle, and of course then plus an electron above the Fermi edge, and this would mean that we create two more quasi-particles, and such terms should be eliminated. Well, actually, if one gets rid of such terms, then the problem turns out to be much simpler. Well, then you can ask yourself, now, how is it with the energy of the system without any quasi-particle? and hopefully that's already the ground state. And then you ask for states with one quasi particle, and then these are, so to say, electrons above or holes below. And then you can even go on with two quasi particles, but in order then to find out what happens with two quasi particles, one is then really left only with a diagonalizing a two particle problem and no longer an n particle problem. And now one can use such a procedure at zero temperature, but now here for the Hubbard model, the way we approached it was to say, well, we are interested at which temperatures does this model become unstable against a certain symmetry breaking phases. And therefore, we had to do it for finite temperatures. Now, at finite temperatures, well, there is a Fermi edge is no longer, well, let's say it's somehow smoothened. The Fermi function goes down continuously, and therefore this concept doesn't make sense. We have to introduce something which is somehow slightly different. Now, what I show here you is a kind of general scheme. One can ask that a certain functional of the Hamiltonian, well, in most cases it will be bilinear, should be minimized. For example, one can choose these G's so that here one has a sum over, well, the, let's say, over the off-diagonal matrix elements multiplied by their Hermitian conjugate. Well, if one does this, then actually we require what we required initially, that also off-diagonal matrix elements go down. But one can formulate it in a more general way. And then the question is how does we would like to minimize it. This means as a function of L. Now, how does...
So in terms of frequency, it will be something like usually. It can be everything. But usually, it will be just a product of all fermions, the whole stuff.
Pardon?
The whole stuff will be the product of all fermions, or will be a product of
eight
fermions or so on?
No. Well, actually, here you could consider these matrix elements as any matrix elements within your Hilbert space.
In principle. Yes.
Yeah.
And then you put in the choice that you do.
Ah, I come to this, yeah. Okay. Now, first, I would like to show what is a kind of argument. Now, we would like to have it in such a way that this decreases. Now, it's easy to write down what the differential of g is. And therefore, we obtain dg to dl in this way. Well, that's still with an arbitrary choice of eta. Well, since this is simply the dh to dl. And one can rewrite it in this form. And then it turns out that this commutator is anti-Hermitian. And therefore, in order that this becomes negative, we choose eta to be just this commutator. That's a basic idea. If we make such a choice, then dg to dl will be negative. Now, of course, it's a question, well, what should we do in practice? It was your question. Now, in the case of electron-phonon interaction, for example, one could use as, well, one could write this HR in such a form where this operator V is a number of phonons. Now, of course, if you calculate the commutator with some term in the Hamiltonian, then you get the same term of the Hamiltonian multiplied by the difference of the number of phonons. And if we do it twice, then it's multiplied by the square. This means we always get it some contribution to HR if the number of phonons is not conserved. But if it is conserved, then of course it commutes and we have zero. And well, what corresponds to this HR is this G here. Therefore, we can write it down. Now, one can do something similar if, by choosing V as a number of quasi particles. Well, then again, it's multiplied by the square of the change of the number of quasi particles. Actually, I don't need this here. Now, well, actually, one can also use more than one of them. Well, in some cases, it may be useful. Now, what will we choose in our case for V? Now, I will choose something like this. It means a one particle operator. Then, of course, it's easy to perform the computation. And but the question is, what do we require? Now, what we require, what I would like to require, is the following. I would say it's too difficult to diagonalize the Hubbard Hamiltonian completely. Probably you agree. No, well, of course, one. But let me also say the following. Why don't we try to perform a unitary transformation, so to say, that in one step we really get it diagonalized? I think one of the obstacles is that this unitary transformation would be probably very complicated. And it's somehow too difficult to find it. Instead, what the strategy is to say, let's perform a transformation so that we get an effective interaction where we know how we can handle it. And such an effective interaction is of molecular field type. This means what we would like to do is to bring our Hamiltonian to molecular field type form. And this means, for example, that let's say here in the interaction, what we would like to keep, example, in order to so that we can deal with superconductivity, is these terms where this momentum plus this momentum equals zero. And therefore, we choose our V in such a way that it has a property that in this case it is zero. And we can do it by requiring that Vk equals minus V minus k. Then if you perform the commutator by performing the commutator with this operator, you obtain a factor Vk. And then you do it with this, you obtain an additional factor Vk2, and if the sum equals zero, then since Vk plus V minus k equals zero, there will be no contributions. This means in this case, and of course similar also for these operators, it will turn out that then this term of the Hamiltonian is multiplied simply by zero. But as soon as the sum of the momenta here is no longer zero, we can arrange that then we get something different from zero, and it means that then it contributes to HR and it will be eliminated. But also it will be eliminated in a soft way, since we assume that these Vk are some continuous functions, and therefore if the sum of these two momenta is only a little bit different from zero, then, so to say, the elimination process will be rather slowly, whereas if it is large, then we will eliminate it rapidly. Now, of course, we also would like to keep anti-ferromagnetic ordering, or quite general, some operators where the total wave vector is Q0, while this is pi. And in order that this works, we also require this condition. Now, that's basically what we do, and...
But you have an explicit formula for those V-alphas, V-alpha K's that you want to put in?
Well, the point is is the following. We did here, we used it by now for a calculation in second order in V, and then it turns out that these conditions here are sufficient so that finally all the corresponding vectors cancel against each other. Well, in practice, it means that in going from this interaction to the interaction one has in HR, these matrix elements have to be multiplied by some factor R, and that's the explicit form for this this elimination factor R, and this elimination factor R is zero for all the types of interactions we would like to keep, molecular field type of interactions, and for the alphas, if I introduce several of these alphas, it can be done in such a way that then it's different from zero. Now, in first order, in the interaction, it turns out that the calculation is very similar. One has only to perform twice the commutator with this kinetic part. And from this, one finds somehow similar to what we had for the electron-phonon interaction, that in first order it decays like this. And of course, I didn't write again all the wave vectors. And then we wrote down the calculations for the second order in V. Now they are more complicated. I don't show them to you explicitly. But then we perform the integration over L. And then finally, it turns out that we have fractions and the R in the numerator and the denominator are all the same, and therefore they cancel. And this actually means that we need not make really a specific choice for the functions V. Now, what does it mean? We start out from the usual Hubbard model, and what we finally obtain, or what we calculate up to second order in U, are all these terms here. Of course, this is for superconductivity. I didn't write down explicitly the spin variables, but for example, here we have anti-ferromagnetism. Here we have magnetism and Pomeranchuk instability. Well, basically, from our choice, it also comes out that we are left with something like this. It would be some kind stackered of superconductivity. But we did the calculation, but we never found a case where this really played a role. Therefore, I think there's no reason to assume that one will obtain such an ordering. Now, how did we analyze it for the instabilities? Now, since we have molecular field type Hamiltonian, we write down the free energy for this Hamiltonian. Now, that's what we obtain from the interaction. Of course, these matrix elements have to be calculated. They are temperature dependent. And then also the entropy has to be taken into account. One simply has to expand the entropy to second order in these order parameters. And from this one can obtain these factors Fk, which are also temperature dependent. And yeah, then one has this quadratic form. It's rewritten here a little bit. And actually, then this means one has to analyze this matrix, and one has to find out at which temperature does it happen that one of the eigenvalues becomes minus one. As soon as this happens, then the system becomes unstable against such a perturbation.
I lost a little bit. So we have done this kind of step or normalization point, but then you have this Hamiltonian. Then you analyze that in something which is essentially RPA. Is that correct? Or altri forca? But in simplicity, you have an Hamiltonian which
No.
The non-permiliquid parts. Yeah. He only has forward scattering. That's why it's soluble.
You see what has happened is the following. Normally, you have three independent momenta, but here we have only two independent momenta, and therefore it means that something like this is an order parameter or something like this, and so on. And now, according to this, it means that we have no longer the fluctuation problem.
Okay. So there's something that essentially you can treat like RPA or like let's say the Fermilitic departure. There is no more really a transfer moment. It's Q equals zero stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Q equals zero and Q equals Q zero. Yeah. Okay.
But does it really float to that? I mean, when you iterate your RG, or is that? Or is that up to terms of order U to the fourth?
What I really calculate is up to second order, the interaction up to second order in U. It's a kind of effective interaction, and then I look whether the interaction has instabilities with respect to the order parameters. Therefore, the question is still the symmetric, the symmetric state stable, or is it unstable in the sense if I change a little bit one of these order parameters, that then the free energy goes down. Simply the question is, do I have at zero order parameter still the minimum of the free energy? And I look, where does it happen that it becomes unstable? And this determines TC. Yeah, before I now really come to this, I have to say a little bit more about the order parameter and the symmetries. Well, of course, I already told you that I consider these order parameters, and well, actually here I should subtract the value at the what you have without interaction. Now, of course, the situation is like a little bit more complicated. Well, we have particle-particle channels, and we have particle-hole channels. Here, we distinguish between spin singlet and spin triplet. Well, of course, also here one distinguishes. But on the other hand, we will finally also use representations under C4. And then for the particle-particle channel, it's already determined by the parity of the representations. On the other hand, well, we have contributions for Q equals 0, homogeneous one, and we have staggered ones. And for staggered ones, again, one can distinguish what happens if one adds Q0. There are contributions where one has the same sign and some where the sign changes.
What is the physical meaning of the second term in particle-particle channel? It looks like full differential superconductivity. Especially homogeneous of the parameter. Your second
this one?
Yeah, no, in particle-particle channel.
Ah, sorry, yeah.
Yeah. So what's the physical meaning? Why physically does it appear here? Because it looks like full differential superconducting states is in homogeneous order parameter change.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it would be would be something like this. Well, it simply said with our choice of HR or of eta, it turns out that I also obtain the corresponding terms in the Hamiltonian. And
comment on that. And the point that if for instance there is some phase which is a phase in which you have both superconductivity and antiferromagnet, this quantity will be surely be present.
No, it would be if you have ferromagnetism and superconductivity, then it would be present.
No, antiferromagnet is this in Q naught which is a large one, no? So if you have antiferromagnet and superconductivity, you have also something like that. So somehow it's taking consideration to have all these phases. So we have also allowed that there is a breaking of translational symmetry. Mm-hmm. We use Q by vector, not only the particle or channel, but also the particle-particle channel.
Right?
It's still a singlet.
Sure.
It's just the problem, instead of having a system with translational invariance,
yeah.
Now we allow that there is some modulation with the Q vector, then also the anomalous order parameter, we have this kind of symmetry. So it's correct.
So this what, yeah,
well, it can be singlet, but
yeah.
Also triplet.
Yeah, you're right.
Pardon?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I think it's triplet. If you have antiferromagnetism and
it's not
superconductivity,
this one is will be antiferromagnetism.
D vector superconductivity, I think this one then is triplet automatically.
If it's D wave.
Yeah, if it's D wave. Yeah, if it's D wave and if you have the usual antiferromagnetism, then necessarily there is this triplet.
Well, if it's D waves, then I think it has to be singlet, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and this means that basically we have 3 × 3 × 5, well, can say different channels to consider. Well, the computer did it, but it turns out, well, if we consider finally the results, then of course not all of them play a role. And actually, for a number of them, one really had to think about what the meaning would be. Actually, from what we observed, the following ones. This means anti-ferromagnetism, Pomeranchuk instabilities, superconductivity, flux phase, but also one, well, I call it band splitting. Well, if this appears, then it means that since a band will split into two separate ones, and we also saw some magnetic ones, of course, depending on the parameters. Now, I think I need not emphasize that, of course, most of them have been observed and described before. But let me show you what we obtained for T primed equals zero and half filling. I should make two remarks. One remark is, I've plotted U over T, but of course, these values of U over T going up to 10 or in some pictures up to 8 are very large, and one has to have reasonable doubts that from a calculation in second order in U, well, actually it's an expansion in U over T, one can go out so far. Therefore, I would say what is further out is something which well, may be interesting that it appears in this calculation, but it doesn't mean that it really well, it may mean that one should look at it, but it's not guaranteed that one will really observe it if one does more calculations.
Now, is it clear that the expansion parameter is U over T and not U over the bandwidth? Because the bandwidth would be more like 8T.
Well, say,
isn't it
4T?
Okay, depends on how you normalize. That's a question of how you normalize your robbing.
Okay.
Ah.
Okay. No, then divide all the numbers by four. But
okay.
Then, of course, 10 is divided by 4 is still a number. It's a large number. Sorry.
It's a serious question because we know roughly that when U is around 2 times or 1.5 times the bandwidth, that's when, for example, from large dimensions, really non-perturbative things start to emerge. The perturbation theory in U is reasonably controlled up to values of U of the bandwidth, for example. So it may not be so bad.
Well, actually, I think we can one can see it a little bit. Well, you see, second preliminary remark. Here I show you different phases. Now, this does not mean that, for example, if we are at this value of U over T and go down in temperature, that then we have a Pohn-Maranchuk instability, then we have this one, then it becomes anti-ferromagnetic and so on. It's well known that one type of order may prevent another type of order. And these are calculated as if all other orders were not present. Therefore, somehow, there remains a question, what happens if we have several of them? Will one exclude the other, or will it not? I think this may really depend on the type of order.
Franz, I'm confused by this diagram. This is half-filling, right?
Yes, half-filling.
It is half-filling, and so...
it's a critical temperature.
Square lattice, right?
Yes, the usual square lattice.
The critical temperature has to be taken with some grain of salt, right? It's not really...
No.
Because there is salt.
Well, these are the critical temperatures which come out from this calculation. Well, it's...
You see the trend looks okay. You see the TC is going to zero, a weak coupling, and at strong coupling. So this is almost what you have in dynamic mean field.
Well, actually,
the thing which I don't understand is why the maximum is when
there is a different definition of the band. Probably the band.
The
probably
definition
four.
Of the band. I'm not matching.
So the band probably is 40.
Or
In our calculations, the bandwidth is 40.
So essentially the maximum is when you use a lot of the band wrong. Which, okay. It's 40 of the band.
Yes, that's right.
So you are discussing where the maximum of the antiferromagnetic thing is, right?
Right.
Okay, now if you...
yeah, it shouldn't be.
If you listened to Gabi, then well, he already indicated, well, as you know from molecular field theory, the critical temperature increases for the antiferromagnetism, but also one knows that at large values of U in the strong coupling limit, the critical temperature goes down again. Well, just think about the TJ model, there you see that J is proportional to 1 over U. And now it turns out that, and we found this very nice, that it really goes down. But on the other hand, then it goes down too fast. Well,
yes.
I think it should flatten out.
The fact that it's not really aligned for zero temperature is because it's too difficult to evaluate, or all,
yes.
All of them just arrive over
there. Well, it's too difficult to evaluate, and actually we performed the evaluation always well for in steps of 100 of dc over t. Well, in practice the calculation goes so that one performs a calculation for various values of dc over t, and then one looks what is the critical u. Well, it's a practical calculation, but it's better to plot it in such a way.
But which is the numerically difficult step that prevents you from going to lower temperatures? Is it the solution of the mean field equations?
Well, the calculation of the effective interaction becomes really difficult. Well, the problem is the Fermi function enters. And of course, then if the Fermi function drops suddenly somewhere, it's difficult to perform the calculation, at least in the way we did it. I don't know if one can find a better way. That's the reason. Actually, we also had some problems even here at low temperatures. This means below 0.05. It turned out if we took lattices of different lattice sites, we do it in Q space, but then it turned out that the result in this region were somehow dependent on the lattice size, and of course this should not be the case. Now we have improved certain things, for example the calculation of the entropy factors, and then it turns out that things become smoother. But below it's too difficult, that's antiferromagnetism. Then one finds Pomeranchuk instability. Well, actually, Metzner and Halbot have also found such an instability. Well, here we obtain another instability. That's what I called band splitting. Therefore, if this happens, then the band would change. Well, actually, do you know what Pomeranchuk instability is? Well, if we, well, at half filling, and we consider this for T primed equals zero, so this is a Fermi edge, but if such a Pomeranchuk instability appears, then one should obtain a Fermi edge which is deformed in such a way, but you can have it equally well rotated around by 90 degrees. Both are equivalent, but that's always if one has some symmetry breaking.
Maybe just a comment.
Yeah.
I don't believe that this thing happens this case at half filling for T prime equal to zero, because then, as you said already, there's a
partition of instabilities, and certainly there's this later gap coming with the antiferromagnetism, which then goes into the MOT gap, and stronger coupling will be so big that it kills this other effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a chance if you put in some T prime and so that the nasty thing is killed.
Now the next instability you find is this.
The bus splitting was what? First is the Pomerantian instability. The BSPP is what?
It's a P wave contribution. Well, actually, it's this one. You see also, as I write here Q minus, it means that it's a staggered one.
It's always a band instability. You were saying it's a band instability.
Yeah, well, it's you see, it's particle hole and also in the singlet channel. And okay, well, it would yield something like this. But on the other hand, well, if I am not sure that it appears if some other kind of transition appears before. Now this is a superconductive D plus one, and actually it is degenerate with the flux phase instability, actually both for singlet and triplet. It's in this case at half filling. Now with a little bit of one.
The question is whether the Pomerantian instability breaks rotational symmetry. It does, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Now, this is with a little bit of doping. You see N equal 1.06. Then we still have some antiferromagnetism, but actually it turns out that it becomes at lower temperature, more difficult for the system to become anti-ferromagnetic. Well, it's simply so that with doping, if you consider the Fermi edge, then of course there are no longer wave vectors from one point of the Fermi edge to the other one with wave vector Q zero, and therefore this becomes suppressed here. The other instabilities are still here, but now it turns out that the superconducting one is stronger than the flux phase one. But actually, I always use flux phase with Q0, therefore, somehow the idea is that this is most appropriate for half filling, but not if one has a different doping.
So in your unitary transformation, do you choose the Q0 or how does that Q come out?
I choose Q0, yeah. I've designed it in such a way that I keep all the terms where the...
And you would choose any Q0?
No, Q0 is always pi pi.
Must be pi pi.
Yeah.
Could you implement in commensurate values?
Commensurate should be possible. Well, incommensurate then basically would probably mean that all of these V's is zero, and then it's then doesn't work. But if it is commensurate and let's say not, well, of course it also depends on how this fraction would look like. Yeah. Okay, then I think that's at fun. Now with T primed equal minus T over 6, well, no more antiferromagnetism. Well, that's a filling, actually Van Hove filling. And once again, these the other ones, of course, they now
look kind of differently. There's something which I don't understand. It turns out now that the that the singlet and the triplet channel of, for the flux phase are no longer degenerate, and moreover, the triplet one would be stronger than the singlet one. It's not quite clear what this means. Okay, flux phase again means that one has a particle hole, and well, it has d plus. Let me see. This is one. Let me see. Again, one has an alternating matrix elements, and it has a D plus symmetry. Well, in practice, it looks like this. Now you probably know it was, first considered by Gabi Kotlia and also by Affleck and Marston, and recently also discussed by Chakravarti. What it means that one adds an imaginary part to the Hopping terms in these flux phases in such a form. What it means you can put it this way: if you hop in the direction of the arrow, then you add it with one, the imaginary part with a certain sign, and in the opposite direction with the opposite sign.
No, but I mean a triplet phase, so you're saying there is also a triplet channel, so for instance.
Yeah, it's a triplet channel. Yeah, this means that then, C dagger and C are combined in such a way that one has to put in a Pauli matrix. Yeah, this is now, if it is minus 1/3, well, what we obtain in our calculation. Things appear now. Well, of course, that's very far down, but this would be a Pomeranchuk instability G plus. Well, we see it in the C plus channel, and then we were a little bit afraid it would really mean that the system becomes unstable. This means the compressibility would diverge, but then we looked and we found that there are nodes in it, and therefore it is G plus, and this would not happen.
So you are hole doping, and the sign of C prime over C, is that corresponding to the high temperature superconductors or what is it? So I'm asking.
Pardon, which sign?
You know how does the furnace respond? Just a question of science here.
Well, let's see. This is at Van Hove.
Okay.
So far, I think it's clear, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then we have also some results for minus 5 T primed equals minus 5 over 12. Here, actually, some magnetic phases come in. This would be an S star phase. This means one doesn't have one in the same sign for the order parameter for all Q vectors, but it changes approximately at the Fermi edge. Well, it may be that some kind of weak magnetism would result out of this. And we also have a P wave contribution, actually rather strong. And it seems to us that this is, would be something like a phase where electrons with spin in one direction move, well, in, let's say with spin up, move in one direction and spin down, move in the opposite direction.
You are still nearby the Ivanov singularity with this.
Well, actually, sets a little bit below, but I think very close to the Van Hoff singularity, one has this kind of picture.
The question is, do you find something which there is nothing?
Okay. The question is what means nothing. If U over T is sufficiently large, if U over T is sufficiently large, then okay. Well, you see the point is it seemed to me rather uninteresting to show you something where you don't see anything, so to say. But I think that's maybe already close to what you. What you ask for. Well, now it's again this, but it's well above Van Hoff filling.
Can I ask you the Kumaranchuk? Is that, can that sort of naively be understood simply when you're close to the Van Hoff, you like to sprint the Van Hoff? Is that a point seed out of this thing here? You simply make a distortion so that you sprint the Van Hoff.
Yeah, but it does not only happen at Van Hoff. It may. Well, actually, if one is not at Van Hoff, I think it means that it's somehow distorted, but I think it need not mean that it's really split. You see, let's say we are well below Van Hoff, so that it's somehow closed, and then I think what it would mean is that somehow would only be deformed in a kind of elliptic way.
That's right. But I was thinking the mechanism why the Kumaranchuk instability would be the first one is simply Kyle's instability. If you like that, you have the degenerative and over-singularity. It's degenerative of all these.
Yeah.
In which case you split the
okay.
It's so that
At Van Hoff, it should be stronger, of course. In the other cases, yeah.
And that's if you go for recoupling where the thing is really controlled, then you have a chance to find it only close to the one over thing, and then something like that.
Right. And that wins over the D wave?
Pardon?
When the it wins over the D, not the D wave. Which one is the dominant instability, the D wave or the Pomeranchuk?
Okay, well, if you're below here, then, well, it's a superconducting one.
Well, they can coexist.
Uh-huh.
Well, but the D wave gets a little bit distorted, of course.
Sure.
Okay, now let me see. Finally, a short conclusion. Well, one thing which one has realized is that the Hubbard model shows surprisingly many possibilities of orderings at low temperatures. Now, future goals are to investigate this also in the symmetry Brogan phases. Well, I have already done a little bit with your method also in this direction. And now another point is, of course, the calculation was only up to second order in the coupling. And well, it would be interesting, but it seems that it's not so easy to perform, to have the calculation now really with respect to the flow parameter L and not simply to cut down the calculation at second order as we did here. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, yeah.
Ferromagnetic instability is also possible.
Well, in this calculation, we did not observe this. But I think on the other hand, let's say the Stoner criterion somehow would be in favor of this. Well, if T primed over T comes close to minus 1/2, as I understand him. And I don't know. I think I have to look again into some details of the of our calculation, but here we didn't observe it.
I have a question. Yeah. Can you say philosophically how is this connected with the renormalization group approach? Because after all, compared to weak coupling, both are using U as an expansion parameter, and it seems that the approaches are close, but.
I think that U is used as a as an expansion parameter. This has somehow only to do that. Otherwise, it's too difficult to handle the problem. No, I think what is somehow common to both approaches is that one somehow transforms the Hamiltonian, or one transforms certain upper quantities, let's say certain vertices or so, in a way where one somehow eliminates those degrees of freedom which are important for or which contribute to fluctuations, but which one would like somehow to get rid of. I think that's one thing which they have in common. Another thing is, in these renormalization group calculations, one somehow considers, the wave vectors closer and closer to the Fermi edge and eliminates everything else around. That's actually one thing I don't do here, but you see what I do in this approach is really to handle it in such a way that finally I have molecular field approximation. I could also say that somehow I eliminate all contributions where, transferred momentum is below a certain wave vector, and this wave vector is lowered. Well, it's not sharp, but I think normally you perform these transformations sharp. Well, here it's more a smooth transformation, but I think also with insofar there is some similarity.
So in a given sense, the transformation you are doing is a transformation in which you are eliminating the dangerous element from the interaction, just provide to something which is the fixed point interaction, for instance. Mm-hmm. The final stuff for that, you have all the scatter, all momenta, you make this kind of transformation, you arrive to something which is essentially the Landau functional, because there is no more any kind of scatter finite. Now I have a question for that. In the sense that in doing that in Landau, you just know that the theory is a theory which is just valid for very small k. That is, when k is very near to the Fermi surface.
Yeah.
Now, in this stuff, I don't know where disappeared this information. This kind of Hamiltonian you are getting you have not to take really as the full Hamiltonian for any k, you just restrict your analysis to start this model.
Yes. Okay. I didn't say this. Well, the point where it appears is somehow are these entropy factors. Therefore, I wrote down something like, yeah, I don't know if I find it now. But you, I don't know whether you remember this quadratic form. And yeah, here. You see, here, this Fk. It turns out that if one evaluates it, in particular at low temperatures, then yeah, I have to distinguish a little bit. For example, here in this particle hole sector, and also for this one, it turns out that Fk increases very rapidly if one goes away from the Fermi edge. And this means, of course, yeah, I didn't write down it explicitly, but in order to get A and B, one has to divide by these square roots. And therefore, it means that then these quantities become very small. Well, in some cases, we even neglect some since they are too far away from the Fermi edge. But I should also mention, well, it's true for this and, yeah, this. If one looks at the Fermi, at this entropy factors, for example, here, this means for superconductivity or for antiferromagnetism, then this go, well, again, they increase, but by far not so rapidly. Therefore, I always have the impression that in these channels, one should be much more careful about what is going on if we go a little bit further out from the Fermi. It is Cooper pair. Well, it means C decker with momentum zero, and in the anti-ferromagnetic one, C decker C with momentum Q zero. The wafer is really different in types of channels. Yeah.
Coming back also to Gabi's question, I mean, it's clear that both methods, recoupling is a control parameter. I think the goal of both methods is either to treat problems which leverage infrared physics, where you have small denominator problems and divergences is into infrared. What is not completely clear to me, while the RG applied, say, to one-dimensional systems easily manages to recover the starting delicate physics, power loss, and so on, if carried out in the appropriate order, here it's not clear to me whether, for example, applying this to a one-dimensional system at second order, say, whether you could get the power loss for Lapin delicate response function, say, to appear in one order in the normalization. Do you have an idea?
Well, at least for the, I don't know how to do this here in general, but for the Luttinger model, well, in the limit n going to infinity, I calculated the correction to the, well, to the occupation number in order 1 over n, and then it turns out that one really gets a logarithmic correction which is due to the power law.
Yeah,
and in this sense,
but does the method sort of have a chance to sound the if you go to finite n, then the logarithm becomes a power law?
Well,
so
it seems to me,
easy,
if you write it in the right variable.
For example, for the Kondo
yeah,
model,
but,
we
as
had a talk here by Pushke about their work on the Kondo model. And in the Kondo model, you have basically two handles, the strong coupling.
Yeah,
and the zero interaction.
Yeah, but that's done with this trick of basically bosonizing that and knowing that the fixed point looks something like a resonant level model. And then.
Was it for
the. That's what you were saying. I mean, you have to know it all.
Was it for the isotropic? Isotropic
no,
interaction?
No.
Or
anisotropic?
Or anisotropic, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
expected state.